with your host, Sheila Ferrando, on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal, or worldwide at ckut.ca.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minnesota, the doctor who tried to save George Floyd's life at a Minneapolis emergency room last May testified Monday asphyxia was the likely cause of Floyd's death, with no evidence Floyd was killed by a heart attack or drug overdose. Dr. Bradford Langenfeld's testimony came as the second week of former police officer Derek Chauvin's murder trial got underway. Also testifying was Minneapolis Police Chief Arredondo, who told prosecutors Chauvin violated department policies and showed a disregard for life when he kneeled on George Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes. It was a rare instance of a police chief testifying against a former officer.
But once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Police Chief Arredondo is among a number of high-ranking law enforcement officials who've condemned Derek Chauvin's actions during the trial. Yet Chauvin racked up 18 complaints over his 19-year career as a police officer, raising questions about why he remained on active duty at the time of George Floyd's killing. The United States reported over 79,000 new coronavirus infections Monday as cases continue to rise nationwide, led by soaring rates of infection in Michigan. In Montana, Republican Governor Greg Gianforte, who ended a statewide mask mandate in February and pushed local governments to drop COVID-19 restrictions, has tested positive for coronavirus. Governor Gianforte received his first dose of Pfizer vaccine 4 days before his positive test result, which came a day after he attended Easter Sunday services at Grace Bible Church in Bozeman. In Waco, Texas, thousands of college students who'd gathered in Baylor University's football stadium to watch the NCAA basketball finals rushed the field Monday night after their team won the national championship. The students packed together for celebrations, few of them wearing masks. Meanwhile, in Arlington, Texas, over 38,000 fans packed the home opener of the Texas Rangers Major League Baseball team Monday. The Rangers said masks were required, but the rule was widely flouted. It was the first time in over a year that any professional sports team in the U.S. has allowed its stadium to fill to capacity. As of Monday, just 16% of Texas residents had been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Florida has become the latest state to open vaccinations to everyone 16 and older. The move follows accusations that Republican Governor Ron DeSantis prioritized wealthy communities that were connected to political donors for vaccination pop-up sites. The Biden administration has set up its own federally run vaccination sites in Florida's biggest cities to combat what it says are racial disparities in vaccine distribution. This is White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
17% of Florida's population is African American, but less than 7% of vaccinations have gone to African Americans in the state. That's one of the reasons that we opened 4 FEMA sites in Miami, Tampa, Jacksonville, and Orlando. And these sites just proportionally serve communities of color.
Ukraine has tightened public health measures as a surge of COVID-19 cases is threatening to overwhelm hospitals. It's part of a massive wave of coronavirus infections sweeping Europe and Latin America. Saudi Arabia says it'll open Islam's holiest site in Mecca to pilgrims throughout the month of Ramadan, but only to those who've been vaccinated against COVID-19 or who've recovered from the disease. Public health agencies are warning Haiti has yet to receive a single dose massive COVID-19 vaccine for its 11 million people, with further delays now likely to postpone a scheduled first shipment of vaccines due to arrive in May. The Pan American Health Organization says Haiti's government failed to apply for a pilot program that would have sped up deliveries of doses under the UN's COVAX initiative. Haiti remains in deep political turmoil after U.S.-backed Jovenel Moïse refused to leave office after a five-year term as required by Haiti's constitution. In February, the Biden administration sided with Moïse's claim that he can serve for another year. The Biden administration's lifted Trump-era sanctions imposed on International Criminal Court prosecutor Fatou Bensouda and another top ICC official for the court's investigation into U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. Secretary of State Tony Blinken, however, reaffirmed U.S. opposition to the probe, as well as to the ICC's investigation into Israeli war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. Israel's president has given Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a chance to form a coalition government after elections in March failed to produce a clear winner for the fourth consecutive round of voting. This comes as Netanyahu's corruption trial has opened at a district court in Jerusalem. Netanyahu is accused of bribery, fraud and breach of trust. On Monday, the former CEO of an online news site testified he was ordered by the company's owner to drop negative stories about Netanyahu and to trash his rivals. Prosecutors say, in exchange, Netanyahu enacted regulatory decisions worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the owner. Netanyahu is also accused of trying to push tax breaks to benefit an Israeli billionaire movie producer after receiving gifts from him, including expensive cigars and champagne. Netanyahu has repeatedly lashed out at reports over corruption, calling them fake news.
This is how they try to overthrow a powerful prime minister from the right. This is what an attempt at a coup looks like.
Back in the United States, Senate Democrats have unveiled a plan to overhaul the U.S. taxes on corporations more than 3 years after President Trump and Republican lawmakers cut the top corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. On Monday, West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin said he opposes a White House plan to raise the corporate tax to 28%, saying he might be open to a partial rollback of Trump's corporate tax cut to 25%. Manchin's a key swing vote in the evenly divided Senate. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called Monday for a minimum global corporate income tax to help pay for President Biden's proposed $2.25 trillion infrastructure and jobs plan. This comes as a new study finds at least 55 of the wealthiest U.S. corporations, including FedEx, Duke Energy and Nike, paid $0 in taxes last year on tens of billions of dollars in profits. Arkansas Governor, Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson, has vetoed a bill that would have criminalized doctors providing gender-affirming treatment to transgender youths following massive pressure from activists against the legislation. The governor spoke from Little Rock Monday.
House Bill 1570 would put the state as the definitive oracle of medical care, overriding parents, patients, and healthcare experts. While in some instances the state must act to protect life, the state should not presume to jump into the middle of every medical, human, and ethical issue. This would be and is a vast government overreach.
This bill could still become law if Arkansas's legislature votes to override the governor's veto. Republican lawmakers in at least 17 other states are considering similar bills. This comes just a month after Governor Hutchinson signed a bill into law aimed at banning trans women and girls from participating in sports. Meanwhile, Virginia has become the first state in the South to ban individuals charged with killing LGBTQ people from using so-called gay and trans panic as a defense for lesser charges or a reduced sentence. The legal defense has allowed individuals accused of murder or manslaughter to argue that the victim's gender identity or sexual orientation was what provoked them to commit the crime. The legislation was introduced by Virginia House Delegate Danica Rome, who became the first transgender lawmaker elected to a state legislature. And in Missouri, people incarcerated at a St. Louis jail led another uprising Sunday, protesting the facility's inhumane conditions during the pandemic and demanding an end to cash bail and for court hearings to be resumed. Videos posted on social media show prisoners standing in front of broken windows, yelling and holding signs that read, "Help us." Others lit small fires and chanted their demands to people outside the jail. This is at least the fourth uprising at the St. Louis City Justice Center since December, according to the Associated Press. Missouri State Rep. Rasheen Aldrich Jr. said in a statement, quote, "The detainees are being held without trial and unable to pay their bail, causing a system that disproportionately puts poor and Black people behind bars. If we care about justice, these systems need to change," unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals. It is not okay to vandalize Asians and other marginalized-owned businesses. We must stop normalizing and stop accepting racist conducts and hate speeches towards all racialized communities. Rather, in these unprecedented times of global pandemic, together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community.
Up cigarette butts off the sidewalk. Don't know why I'm surprised. I'm not amazed by all the different ways of life. They try to tell you that there's more to life than music. Don't know why I'm surprised. It's the same story, different lines. Tried to brush it off, just another day, just another day that you got through. Same way people all around are more or less the same, more or less the best and worst of you. Well, life will tell you a one lesson, even if deep down you're screaming, your fragile egos. It can't be hard to recognize with a hurricane coming up from the inside. Eyes puffing up from the weight of all you know there will be. Reality can't be hard to find. Well, it's the same story, different lines. You could try to brush it off as just another day, just another day that you got through. Same way people all around are more or less the same, more or less the best and worst of you. Well, life will tell you one lesson, even if deep down you're streaming, hell, please let me. We'll tell you it won't listen, even if the
butts off the sidewalk. Picking up cigarette butts off the sidewalk.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. This is the first week things will really start warming up. Welcome to spring. Wednesday will have a mix of sun and clouds at a high of 15 degrees Celsius. Thursday will be mainly sunny with a high of 18 degrees Celsius. Sunday will bring a mix of sun and clouds and a high of 19 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be mainly sunny with a high of 20 degrees Celsius. Sunday will be rainy with a high of 19 degrees Celsius. Monday will be 14 degrees Celsius with rain, and Tuesday will be cloudy with showers and a high of 15 degrees Celsius. Well, that wraps up the show for today. Keep listening to CKUT.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided. It is forbidden to leave your home between 9:30 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about other measures in place to fight COVID-19. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Caitlin, Caitlin, oh, where have you been? Where have you been all my life? You can't know, Caitlin, the trouble I've seen to finally feel so alive. I walked through the hills, through valleys and dells. I swam across rivers and lakes. I've burned several bridges and I've spat in the wells. Oh Lord, I have made some mistakes. Foreign land felt like a home. Just one glance at you, and that's when I knew I'll never again be alone. Caitlin, Caitlin, oh, where have you been? Where?
It was almost love, almost something worth singing about.
Sandra Boza, a voice of power and passion. Songs that touch your heart and fuel your soul. Winner of the Toronto Blues Society Talent Search, Sandra Boza is an R&B, soul, and Americana singer-songwriter. Her latest release, Falling Away From Me, is filled with deep grooves that reveal her sultry and soulful vocals. Catch a live online concert with high-definition sound and videography coming April 10th. Tickets and info available now at sandraboza.com. SandraBouza.com.
Early in the morning, before the sun rose, when the first bird sang, even while everyone was still asleep.
Morning. On that morning
when the sun comes out.
This morning, baby.
Cocky-doodle-doo. I hear the rooster crowing.
Now you must wake up.
Now every morning when I wake up,
I woke up this morning with
the kiss of the morning.
Got up 7:30 every morning. Had the same breakfast.
Réveillez-moi à 8 heures demain matin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Riding a bike made of bacon and eggs.
In the morning.
In the morning.
In the morning.
Why should the sun replace the moonlight?
Has this ever happened to any of you, or will it happen to any of you, on the morning after the night before?
You are listening to The Morning After on CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial.
The people who have lived in two of the biggest refugee camps in the world likely never anticipated they would be there for generations.
They're reluctant guests in a foreign country.
Kenya has hosted the Dadaab and Kakuma camps since the early 1990s. And those camps have hosted hundreds of thousands of refugees, mainly from Somalia.
Famine and violence have stopped many from going back, and Kenya's refusal to let refugees integrate have kept them in limbo.
The camps were meant to be temporary, and the Kenyan government, which has had a tenuous relationship with the camps, is very aware of that. On March 24th, it issued an ultimatum.
Kenya has given the UN 2 weeks to come up with a plan to shut two of the world's largest refugee camps.
The government has called for Dadaab's closure before. So what does this latest ultimatum mean for the refugees living there now? I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take. To talk about this story, we spoke with someone who is deeply familiar with one of those two camps.
My name is Maulid Hojale. I am a Somali journalist, and I've covered extensively the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, where I happen to have lived for quite a long time.
Maulid is now based in London, but I asked him to tell me about where he grew up.
I was born in a beautiful coastal town called Kismayo in southern Somalia. And then after the civil war, we moved to Kenya in the Dadaab refugee camp, close to the border with Somalia.
A difficult and bloody civil war in Somalia led to the overthrow of the dictator Siad Barre in 1991.
Like many Somalis, hundreds of thousands of them, when they fled, that's where they stayed. So the camp was meant to be temporary for us, but we ended up staying there longer because Somalia was not getting any better. And then Dadaab became my home.
Dadaab's camps were first built in the 1990s to accommodate Somali refugees trying to leave the violence of their country's civil war.
The Kenyan government opened Dadaab camp, designed for 90,000 refugees, in 1991 as a temporary solution to the civil war in Somalia.
So how would you describe Dadaab to someone who has never been there? What is life like?
The name Dadaab is very close to me, close to my heart. So Dadaab is not just one camp. It's made up of three camps, namely Ifo, Dagahale, and Hagadera. They are basically like any other city because of the people who live there and the number of years they have been living there. Their schools, their markets, bustling economy, thriving business, the host community and the refugees working together. So there's a lot of activities going on there. You would never expect to have taxis in a refugee camp. You would not expect to have cinema. So young people go to the cinema in a makeshift shelter where they watch the European leagues. And even though the internet connectivity is very limited, but there's internet cafe where people go to connect with their friends in the diaspora. You will see people coming together in the coffee shops. It's just like any other city.
But Maulid said none of that happened overnight.
There was nothing when refugees were coming. In 1991, when the camp was first set up, refugees came from Somalia, and then later other refugees from the region joined from Sudan, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Uganda, as far as Rwanda and Burundi. So it's a cosmopolitan city now because for 30 years, refugees made Dadaab a functioning city out of nothing.
More than 400,000 refugees lived in the camp at its peak.
At the height of the 2011 famine, 1,000 people were arriving here every day.
They've survived not because of any donations or handouts from the aid agencies, but because of the generosity of the refugees who are already here.
though the Kenyan government does not allow permanent structures to be built there, the refugees later on started innovating.
Molid said people in Dadaab started using mud to build bricks and create semi-permanent homes. These are an upgrade from the tents made of white tarps emblazoned with the UNHCR logo that also dot the camp. You can see both of these structures in the many aerial photos that capture Dadaab's expansive but tidy grid stretched out over 30 square kilometers.
To the outside world, it's just a refugee camp, but inside Dadaab, the people who call it home, it's more than a camp for them. It's become home.
Yeah.
There are children who lived there all their lives and don't know anywhere else other than Dadaab.
And just like any other city, there are political institutions that keep things running.
There is a well-organized structure of leadership. There is a mayor who is elected democratically by the refugees. Dadaab is said to be the third largest city in Kenya after Nairobi and Mombasa, which is very interesting. But that's not how the Kenyan government views. It looks at Dadaab through the security prism.
When Molid says the Kenyan government looks at Dadaab through a security prism, he's talking about their concerns over the armed group Al-Shabaab.
I remember when I was there, there was a police crackdown.
Molid says this was in 2011. That year, the Kenyan government sent troops across the border into Somalia to fight Al-Shabaab after a series of attacks in Kenya. And Dadaab, which is right on the border between Kenya and Somalia, was trapped between that fight.
And in the name of fighting Al-Shabaab, the Kenyan forces cracked down on the refugees. And I remember we were running around and they were beating young people. And that is when it dawned on me that there's no way out of this place. There's no fence, there's no gate. But when you try to go to the outside, you'll either cross the border 100 kilometers outside of Dadaab or go to the Kenyan side where there's checkpoints everywhere and police would ask for identification. So that is why many people call it an open prison.
Being stuck has affected everything about the residents' day-to-day lives.
It has become a city out of necessity because they cannot go out to work, but they have created their own local economy. The other interesting thing about the lack of freedom is that the refugees, even though they were born there, many of them born by parents who were also born there, they feel more Kenyan than even Somali, because in the schools what they study is the Kenyan national curriculum. They sing the Kenyan national anthem, but still they're denied the right to exercise their freedom to go and integrate with the host community, which is very unfortunate.
And in addition to being caught in the middle of Kenya and Somalia physically and culturally, they're also caught between the two politically, as tensions between the countries grow. And that could mean the difference between being stuck and being forced out. Remember the announcement we mentioned that Kenya's Interior Ministry made on March 24th of this year?
The government has issued a 14-day ultimatum for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, to close down Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps located in Kenya. The statement alluded to the fact that there will be no room for further negotiations.
Catherine Soy, Al Jazeera's correspondent covering East and Central Africa, told us Kenya's interior minister met with the UNHCR, asking for a plan to close the camps.
That is what the ultimatum was about. Now UNHCR is to submit a report on a timeline for the repatriation of the refugees. We are talking about close to 500,000 refugees. Some are third generation, and it's not just Somalis. We have refugees from the DRC, from Burundi, South Sudan, and so on.
For anyone familiar with Dadaab, this threat to shut down the camp could sound like deja vu.
No one expected Dadaab to be open this long, and if Kenya gets its way, it will be closed by November.
Government officials have made many threats to close the camp. This particular threat was the strongest.
Kenya has repeatedly issued threats to close the camps, but backtracked following interventions from the international community.
In 2016, the government also threatened to shut down the camps because of security threats. This was the height of attacks on Kenya by Al-Shabaab, the armed group in Somalia. Authorities here said that the refugees were harboring and helping some of the attackers.
Here's some of Catherine's reporting from that time.
Al-Shabaab fighters have carried out a series of attacks in Kenya, most notably a university attack where 148 people were killed and another on a popular mall in Nairobi in 2013. 67 people were murdered. Security forces believe that some of the attacks were planned in the camps. I asked this refugee leader if he thinks that the camps have been infiltrated by Al-Shabaab.
In fact,
the problem you're talking about is real, but I cannot talk freely and explain the details. That should tell you something.
But a Kenyan court blocked the government's plan to close Dadaab in 2017, calling it unconstitutional.
Human rights groups challenged that view, calling the government's decision to close the camp discriminatory. And the court agreed, saying the order amounted to collective punishment.
Still, the Dadaab situation has been tenuous, and that status is felt within the camps, as Mawlid says.
When I heard about the news recently about the Kenya's decision to again close the camps, it wasn't a surprise to me. I wasn't shocked because I knew this is something they have done before. And when I talk to the people who still live in Dadaab, they share the same feeling. When this kind of news comes out, that uncertainty disrupts the whole livelihood and the whole local economy. They are frustrated, they are shocked, but it's no longer breaking news to them.
Mawlid connected us with a resident of Dadaab, who told us more.
My name is Dek Abdullahi Ali, who lives in the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. If I talk about what Kenyan government said about the closure of the camps and the pressure and frustrations it caused in the people, it's really very high.
And Dek says these pressures aren't just coming from the Kenyan government. A lack of funding from international donors means there's less support for the refugees' material needs.
In the camps, people don't receive enough supports from the donors because the food ratio was reduced. And the only thing people have now is peace and education. People are hopeless, idle, and they have no say about what Kenya government said about the closure of the camps.
Mawlid, you and I go way back because the first time that I can remember interviewing you was in 2016, and it was on this very same issue. The Kenyan government had issued a call to close Dadaab, and they have done so again and again after a series of attacks from Al-Shabaab in Kenya. So why does the government keep pushing to close the camp, and why hasn't it happened yet?
Kenya, unfortunately, is using the refugees in this country as a bargaining chip. Currently, we know that the Kenyan government and Somalia are not in a good relationship. So whenever Kenya says it's doing this because of its national security, I think it's just a way to justify their move to close the camp. This is more political than humanitarian. It's more political than national security.
And in her reporting, Catherine says she's hearing that too.
People here are just asking, well, is this just rhetoric? The government is again talking of security threats, but we also know there's a huge diplomatic row between Kenya and Somalia. And some people are saying that this is what it's about the tensions. These are long-running tensions over several issues. Somalia, for starters, has always accused Kenya of interfering in its international affairs, particularly in the Jubaland region where the Kenyan forces are situated under the African Union peacekeeping mission.
Those accusations reached new heights in December of 2020 when the two countries cut diplomatic ties. And then there's a dispute playing out in recent weeks in front of the International Court of Justice. It's over an oil-rich territory between the two countries in the Indian Ocean.
Somalia says that Kenya has been exploiting it. It belongs to Somalia, but Kenya is also claiming that particular area. So Kenya also recently pulled out of that case with a lawyer saying that the judges are biased against Kenya. So a lot of problems there.
We asked the Kenyan Interior Ministry to speak with us for this episode, but we didn't get a response before our deadline. Here's what Kenyan news sources have reported on the government's plans should the UNHCR fail to provide a roadmap to close the camps.
The Kenyan government said that should the UNHCR not come up with a plan within 2 weeks, they will simply evacuate refugees from the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camp and place them on the Somalian border.
But Catherine can't imagine that becoming a reality.
It's difficult to see how that can happen in those camps. And specifically talking about Kakuma in northern Kenya, there are refugees from other countries as well. Kenya is also bound by international laws regarding refugees, and there are procedures and logistics because we're talking about hundreds of thousands of refugees. So I think busing them to the border is just out of the question.
Moleed also says it won't be easy for the UN to close the camps.
It's logistically impossible to shut a complex facility that has been there for 30 years. It's not just the responsibility of the UN or even the Somali government. Kenya has a legal obligation to protect these refugees. And let me make clear that Kenya has been generous, but these days I think Kenya is just spoiling its track record and reputation as a generous host country. Whether Kenya wants to close or not, the fact is that refugees who live there do not want to stay there forever. They all want to go back to Somalia or to another place where they can get the freedom they need.
Over the last several years, tens of thousands of refugees in Dadaab have taken part in a UN voluntary repatriation program meant to help refugees return to Somalia. Moleed says that life in the camp has become so difficult that people feel pushed to leave.
Even though the process is voluntary, still refugees will tell you that the conditions in the camp have become so difficult that they ended up signing up to this process.
That repatriation process has been complicated for many of the people who take part in it.
Some of them have reestablished their lives back home, but many of them ended up in internally displaced camps within Somalia. So they left a camp and ended up in another camp, which is more dangerous in terms of the security situation and with less resources and less support that they used to get from Dadaab.
Some people have even returned to Dadaab after attempting to repatriate. But Moleed says the threat of closure might push more people in Dadaab to sign up for the UN's repatriation program.
And I think every time when Kenya says they will force people to go, you will see more people going to the UN asking for repatriation. So Kenya, I think, is using this to pressure refugees to agree to the so-called voluntary repatriation.
So what does that mean now in the coming weeks as the refugees in Kenya face yet another threat of closure? Here's what Catherine had to say.
I think how this will play out, and I could be wrong, is that the UN will submit its report asking for time, a lot of time. The government will perhaps give its own deadline for the plan to be implemented. And maybe even next year, we'll be talking about the same issue. But what this does to the refugees is cause so much uncertainty, so much panic and fear. We saw this in 2016, and we're seeing it now.
Moleed, you have mentioned the uncertainty, and I feel like that is at the heart of this story that some people may gloss over in the headlines about Kenya and Somalia, the two governments. But regardless of what happens next, how does this constant threat of closure that's been going on for years affect people in the camp, especially those who've been there for their whole lives?
This time, it's even worse because refugees have lost hope. Some of them will tell you, let's just go back. We don't want even any repatriation. They should not keep saying this and, you know, disrupting our livelihoods, disrupting our businesses and also our mental well-being. So refugees are really confused and they're really in a very desperate situation now because of this uncertainty.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by Nagin Oliai with Amy Walters, Alexandra Locke, Dina Kispe, May Alvarez, Priyanka Tove, and me, Malika Bilal. Alex Roldan is our sound designer. Natalia Aldana is our engagement producer. Stacey Samuel is our executive producer. We'll be back on Wednesday.
L'émission que vous allez entendre est une rediffusion. The following show is a rebroadcast.
Da-ba-do-da, quand je dis rouge, il faut que ça bouge. Da-ba-do-da, 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 di-da-ba-wa-da. Quand je dis vert, on saute en l'air. Da-ba-do-da, 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 di-da-ba-wa-da. Quand je dis jaune, on est pris dans un cyclone. Ouh, ah, j'ai peur, da-ba-do-da, 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 di-da-ba-wa-da.